And we're back with another episode of The Reporter's File. I'm Saeed Puruza. Many thanks for being with us. Here's the headlines.
A terrorist and the question of accountability. Malnutrition in one of the world's fastest growing economies. Drought forcing Zimbabwe to knock on its neighbors' doors for food. And a look at the history of the Palestinian city of Gaza.
Anders Behring Breivik has left Norway in shock and disbelief. Norwegians never thought it could happen in their peaceful and tolerant society and by one of their own. Breivik committed the worst act of terrorism even in Norwegian history and is now facing justice. But there is quite a dilemma around the issue of his accountability, as Press TV's Rehan Nakvisen reports.
This man is facing the largest trial in the history of Norway. Anders Behring Breivik is a right-wing anti-Islam terrorist. On 22nd of July 2011, in a shooting spree on the Utøya Island, he killed 69 members of the youth wing of Labour Party in Norway. Hours before that, he bombed the government buildings in Oslo, leaving 8 people dead. Breivik considers the Labour Party guilty of letting down the Norwegians by bringing multiculturalism and Islam into the Norwegian society. He has said that the Labour Party needed a lesson and that the purpose of the attacks was to prevent Muslims from taking over Europe. He maintains that he is sane and accountable for his deeds, but the purpose of the trial is really to determine his state of mind, that he is sane or insane.
We have to keep to the laws, which says that if you're psychotic or unconscious, you're not to be punished for your deeds. If he is psychotic, then he is sick in our thinking. And when he is sick, then he is not to be punished because he can't do anything about it. The system allows for him to be regarded as less serious, I think, than people that are declared sane and responsible. This dilemma, if he's sick enough, then he'll go to a hospital anyhow. And then he can kill as many as he wants.
The first psychiatric examination report declared Breivik insane with paranoid schizophrenia. This led to protests by several fractions of the Norwegian society that the report was latently racist, implying that a sane ethnic Norwegian could not have committed such acts of terrorism. A later report did, however, declare him sane and accountable for his deeds. But that report has not been approved by the court yet, on the basis of lack of evidence.
As of today, there is one report that has concluded that he is a psychotic, and I believe that we must relate to that report. There have been many people who have spoken into the media outlet about Breivik, but they have not looked all the matter thoroughly. It is only the court-appointed psychiatrists who have done so, and only they can see the high degree of certainty about his symptoms and diagnosis. After July 22nd, a lot of people in Norway wished for death sentence for Breivik. On the social media, many people have described the torture methods that he should be subjected to. So there's a lot of hatred in the society. And to hate a psychotic person is not supposed to be okay. But it is okay to hate a healthy person who is accountable for his deeds. If he is sick, as the first report suggests, then there should be a possibility that he will someday will be free. Now the government is trying to stop that from happening. They have proposed a law that says that he will be kept in prison on the grounds of his own safety, because someone might pose a danger to his life. Therefore, he should be kept in the prison, even if he is cured. And that is paradox in the law that government is trying to get approved.
Loven som regjeringen nå prøver å få godkjent I Stortinget.
They want to cure him, to give him some medicine, some therapy, whatever, in order to make him better, which is perhaps a crazy thought. Now, what I think is that people should be punished by what they do, by their deeds, and not what they are. I don't think he's insane. That's because his ideas seem to be shared by many people, which is not insanity. With him, some people agree all the time. And that is then it's not a thing that he has picked up by, from his mind. It's from outside, actually.
Norwegians are proud of their law and system of justice. Despite the dilemma the society faces today, many here believe that Breivik has got a fair and transparent trial. Had this been in places other than Norway, such as United States or other European countries, perhaps the trial would have been conducted differently.
They're more strict or more revengeful in a way. And here, we're not, perhaps we're naive in a way, but so let it be.
Reyhan Nekvison, Press TV, Oslo.
India has seen tremendous economic growth and development in recent years. But despite that, hunger and malnutrition continue to plague the country of more than a billion. Malnutrition is threatening an increase in disease and also a high rate of child mortality. This report by Munawar Zaman in New Delhi.
India is growing at its fastest pace in terms of population as well as economy. But despite steady growth and rapid developments, large section of its society continues to suffer from hunger.
According to the Global Hunger Index of the International Food Policy Research Institution, India ranks 67th among the worst 80 countries in terms of malnourishment. And the situation is worse than sub-Saharan Africa.
As far as the numbers of mothers that are exclusively breastfeeding are low, and there's a lot that can be done. So actually ensuring that those behaviors, those issues are supported, campaigns are done to ensure that every mother breastfeeds exclusively every newborn for at least 6 months.
According to experts, the major causes of malnutrition in the country could mainly be attributed to low social status of women and their diet, which often lacks both in quality and quantity. As a result, newborn infants are unable to get adequate amount of nutrition from their mothers. Studies have shown that malnutrition causes about 50% of all childhood deaths in the country and the economic losses of about 3% of annual GDP. Prime Minister Manmohan Singh in his recent statement said that the problem of malnutrition is a matter of national shame.
Policies really don't matter. It's the programs and then, you know, the way they're implemented, that is what really matters. And if you have successes in states like Tamil Nadu, it's because the program was implemented well. If Chhattisgarh is able to revamp its PDS so that even the remotest hamlets are getting access to rice and, you know, dal and oil, it's because the program was implemented well.
In India, food intake alone is not the only reason behind malnutrition among children, but it is influenced by many other reasons like lack of access to healthcare, the quality of care for child and pregnant mother, as well as poor hygiene, resulting in long-term consequences and risk of disease and early death.
India has largest child development programs in the world, but the progress on malnutrition is limited, and the existing nutrition programs are not targeting children properly.
On the other hand, the states with the highest level of malnutrition have the lowest levels of nutrition funding. The government of India is currently running its biggest nutrition programs, like the Integrated Child Development Scheme, which was started in 1975. The National Midday Meal Scheme, the National Rural Health Mission, and the Public Distribution System. But the challenge remains of how to increase efficiency, impact, and coverage of these schemes, according to UNICEF.
Experts say more needs to be done in terms of distribution system and resources. They further stress on an urgent need of a comprehensive food security bill and proper budgetary allocations.
While the government of India is considering steps to enact legislation for an effective food security bill that would establish constitutional rights to food, analysts say the effectiveness would be uncertain due to the inadequate delivery system.
My view is that the food security bill has to be a platform on which nutrition security has to be ensured. And first they have to come to a decision on the agreement for the food security, but just providing that type of foods will not ensure nutrition security. So we will have to then layer nutrition security across the life cycle.
According to analysts, corruption, on the other hand, is a major roadblock for eradicating malnutrition in the country. And the subsidy programs that the country operates never reaches the large section of its recipients. Many health officials also say the country's economic boom in the recent years was confined to a few, and the majority of India's population is deprived of social, economic and educational benefits.
You know, a lot of times the food doesn't get to where it's needed. So really it needs to be decentralized. The food that goes to, say, the ICDS or the midday meal or the PDS should be bought locally, and it should be local foods. And then there is a big problem of corruption, transparency, accountability. So definitely the distribution system needs to be improved. And then
experts say food alone does not ensure better nutrition. There is a need for improved infant feeding, sanitation, clean water, and affordable and accessible health services. They further stress that the country needs good governance and a firm political will to come up with a lasting solution. Munawar Zaman, Press TV, New Delhi.
Zimbabwe is facing a severe shortage of food after most of its farming provinces were hit by a drought. The country is now relying on food imports from its neighboring countries, especially those in the so-called Southern African Development Community, the SADC region. Fazila Mohamed reports.
Many parts of Zimbabwe have succumbed to a devastating dry spell, raising hunger alarms. Reports indicate that the country has begun importing maize, mostly from Zambia. According to Agriculture Minister Joseph Made, Zimbabwe needs over 2 million tons of maize annually. Yet the current stocks are only close to 400,000 tons. This means the current maize stocks are less than half of the annual requirement. The United Nations, UN, last year announced it will raise $200 million of food aid for Zimbabwe. However, funding for various food distributing agencies, including the World Food Programme, WFP, is facing a serious shortfall. Reporters File visited Mashinga province to witness the food situation. Senator for Zaka district spoke to the crew, giving an insight of the disaster in his area.
This year we have witnessed yet another disastrous year as regards food. About 100% total failure of crops in Zaka. Unlike other districts where we may find some mines, some mineral mines, like Bikita, which has got conservatives and other mines, Zaka is a landlocked district, which has got no commercial activity at all besides agriculture.
The government has spearheaded a national grain loan scheme whereby villagers receive 50 kgs of maize from the country's sole grain dealer, the Grain Marketing Board, GMB. Senator Marava, however, said the program was not enough to cover every family, as child-headed families are left out.
Right now we've got a disaster. It's about 2% of the village getting food. 98% getting nothing, and also this distribution of this food is done by traditional leaders who find it also very difficult to choose who is qualifying and who is not qualifying. And we got child-headed families in Zaka, a lot of child-headed families. The pandemic of AIDS has destroyed a lot of families, so you find out that a child who is leading a family is completely at a loss as to how she or he can feed the young brothers and young sisters when not employed.
We also caught up with Member of Parliament for Chivi South in Mashinga province. He also confirmed that hunger crisis is also serious in his area.
My area is equally affected by this the famine. It has got a population of about 80,000 people. We are desperately in need of food. And I also have got a recommendation that we must do away with this dependent syndrome. Whoever wants to assist us to fight this hunger must also be prepared to assist us in coming up with projects like dams so that we irrigate on our own and then get some food for our people.
In an address to the nation at Independence Day, President Robert Mugabe announced the introduction of a food mitigation program, reiterating government's position on fighting hunger in the country.
As a precautionary measure, government has set aside funding for food shortage mitigation programs in the affected areas. Government also continues to enhance social safety net programs targeting children, particularly of the orphaned and vulnerable children and the aged amongst us.
Six provinces out of 10 face severe food shortages. Some governors have, however, banned some non-governmental organizations, NGOs, for dabbling into local politics. The situation has been described by human rights watch groups as putting people's lives in danger. Mashinga has been one of the hardest hit provinces by drought. Most crops have been damaged due to not enough rainfall. Families are in a dilemma. Vazila Mohammed, Reporters File, Mashingo Province.
Despite its small size, Gaza is considered one of the oldest cities in the world. It's rich with history and stories from the different eras and civilizations, as it used to be the route for caravans and armies traveling between the east and the west. Yusuf Al-Halou has this report.
The Gaza Strip, known as Gaza of Hashem, which is related to the great-grandfather of Prophet Muhammad, believed to be the site where he was buried after he passed away during a trading journey. Gaza is one of the oldest cities in the world. Its strategic location on the Mediterranean coastal route enabled it to be the center of trade and a stopover for caravans traveling between Africa and Asia, as well as Europe. The city is deeply rooted in the ancient time, in which many Islamic, Christian, and other historical sites that are still standing.
Gaza was inhabited about 3,000 years ago. It has been dominated by different peoples and empires throughout its history. Gaza has a long history from different periods and civilizations, such as Romans and the Byzantines. A diverse variety of Philistines, Greeks, Romans, Canaanites, Phoenicians, Persians, and Bedouins populated the city. During the Islamic era, many mosques and castles were built, some of them aged over 1,000 years.
The name Gaza is derived from the Semitic word for strong. The city passed through many periods and civilizations and defied all invaders.
The history of Gaza in Palestine goes back over a million years. And despite its small size, it has provided an important part of human civilization and heritage.
There are 40 historical sites discovered throughout the coastal enclave. Many of these sites went under restoration process to maintain and preserve the cultural heritage. This ancient site, known as the Al-Umri Mosque, is about 1900 years old. It is the biggest and oldest mosque in Gaza, located in downtown Darish Quarter.
History books talk about entire cities, castles, places of worship that existed in Gaza. Throughout the Roman period, Gaza was a prosperous city and received grants and attention from several emperors. Some of the ancient sites were discovered by chance, but a lot of effort is needed to continue the excavation work to uncover the other archaeological sites. We lack expertise and experts in this field. Many ancient pieces were either stolen or destroyed during wars and conflicts.
In the Zaytuni Quarter lies the Church of St. Porphyrius and Katib Wilayat Mosque. The minaret of the mosque is adjacent to the built tower of the church. The walls of this site, known as Khan Yunis Castle, which was built over 600 years ago, will remain as a witness of the glory of the place that reflects its civilization. The marvelous Islamic heritage is still standing.
Khan Yunis Castle, which is also known as King Barquq Castle, was built about 630 years ago, during the Mamluk era. It used to be a stopover for caravans that traveled between different regions in Africa and Asia. The castle contained a mosque, market, and resting place. But what is remaining from the castle is only the outside wall.
To the south of Gaza lies St. Hilarion Monastery, which was discovered in 1993. Before its discovery, the ancient site, which is believed to be built 1700 years ago, was buried under sand, not far from the beach of Al Zawaida in the central Gaza Strip. Excavation work has led to the discovery of a beautiful ancient pieces and artistic mosaic. The site houses an entire big abbey. Most of it is still buried underneath this hill, which requires a lot of effort and foreign experts to help finish the excavation work. The geography of the place has been transformed into a history book, which talks about the history and glory of Gaza.
This ancient abbey contains a church, resting rooms, bathrooms, as well as many floors of mosaic. It was built on the top of a hill in this area to oversee the sea route. The site of this ancient place is very big, and we hope to finish the excavation work with the help of French experts.
Meanwhile, the Gaza Museum, which was opened in the summer of 2008, houses antiquities discovered in the Gaza Strip from various historical periods. This makes Gaza deeply rooted in the ancient time. Youssef Al-Hello, Press TV, Gaza.
And that does it for this week's program. Thanks for watching. Continue to write to us and watch us, of course, here on Press TV. Until we meet again next time, goodbye.